Hey folks, this is Craig from Acid Horizon, and it's been a long while since I sat down and recorded one of these fancy intros to say hello and to ask for your support at Acid Horizon. There's so many ways to support us, but today I'd like to focus on our book, Anti-Oculus, A Philosophy of Escape from Repeater Books. You can go ahead to the Repeater website and pick that up alongside the tarot deck that I created a couple of years ago, the Philosopher's Tarot. Also, it is spring and we have new merchandise, which means at the Crit Drip store, you can buy one of the Acid Horizon shirts, sweatshirts, maybe there'll even be a tank top in there by the time I'm done recording this, that has the Acid Horizon logo that you see on the podcasting platforms where we post our podcast. On today's episode, we talk with Tasia Mars McDougall about Deleuze, masochism, and Black Studies. We thank you for your support. So, sometime during this episode or at the end, navigate to the show notes and check out all the links. Find Tasia's Twitter account and find the other links where you can support us. Okay, let's get on to the show.
In this house, we believe that the fundamental problem of political philosophy is that which Spinoza saw so clearly, which Reich rediscovered, and which I have said for the third time in a row because we've had to restart the recording a couple of times. Why do people fight for their servitude as if it were their salvation? Are we all political masochists? Am I a masochist for reading that out three times? Well, we're going to explore masochism again today, folks. We are continuing our ongoing collaboration with the Mimbrous School by talking about masochism, libidinal economy, finance, and racial capitalism with Tasia Mars McDougall. Tasia, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Happy to be here for what feels like the third time, as I've said that a couple of times now. But yes, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah, let's chat.
No, so you recently finished your dissertation, of course. Can you just give us a bit of an introduction to the kind of problematics you're working with, the fields you're working in?
Yeah. So, yeah, I finished my dissertation in, 2022, I guess. It's an insanity document. And what happened with it is I was trying to write about Black time. And then I ran sort of headlong into the money problem with slavery, where I was just sort of caught up in why do we keep calling slaves commodities when they don't seem to function like commodities? They seem to function more like money. And then that became sort of an interrogation of Black studies fixation on specific kinds of commodity functions of slaves, and then a sort of reorientation of this commodity form of the slave toward a financial form, where I sort of conclude with the idea that, you know, Blackness itself, not just the slave, functions as like a libidinal currency or a libidinal money, is a better way to put it. So it started with this critique of Black studies as like this, as a sort of a family model that sort of breaks down through the dissertation into a kind of meeting of strangers in the market kind of model. So that was the diss.
Mm. It's interesting, yeah, this shift from, you know, this almost typical sort of Marxist framing of essentially, like, you know, even if you get sort of, you know, Fred Moten talking about the commodity that speaks, which Marx misses, that this reshifting it to a financial instrument is really interesting. And I think what we're going to talk about today, of course, folks, is going to be this fusion of Deleuze with a particular moment in Black studies around this idea of masochism, which, as you highlight in the talk you sent to us, comes out of Anthony Farley's work, particularly this paper, if people can find it, you know, it's called the Black Body as Fetish Object. So what drew you to thinking about these things in terms of masochism already after you've made the shift to thinking about these things in more financial terms?
Well, I had chosen to revisit this Anthony Farley paper for the Mimbrous School. And I had read it a few times, but I had read it again for this class where I was going to be talking about desire and pleasure. And the class was titled, What is Blackness? And I was, you know, sort of going through different concepts that are sort of in orbit around what we think of as racial blackness. And I had read Coldness and Cruelty a long time ago. And then Noah actually sort of said, hey, why don't we look at this? And I was like, okay, let me revisit it. And so I, like, you know, blazed through it. And then I got sort of halted on this question of the contract and the institution as aligning with masochism and sadism respectively. And, you know, I had really liked Farley's paper at first, but then as I revisited Coldness and Cruelty, I started to get suspicious of what he was doing in this very early paper, because it's, you know, it's from like 1997. I started to really sort of buy what Deleuze was saying about breaking the sadomasochistic entity apart. And so then sort of develop this sort of critique of Farley, you know, 100 years too late, but always on time, I guess. So that the shift into this question about the contract, as I'm thinking about financial instruments, I'm thinking about derivatives and derivatives markets, I'm thinking about options, I started to really delve into the contract as so much of what we like to think of as emancipation in the United States and in, you know, in the Americas, is about the sort of signing of the social contract and how that is supposed to be this founding moment of Black freedom. That was then, you know, it was, a, you know, under Saidiya Hartman's gaze, it's a non-event. So like, what does that all kind of mean? So I'm thinking about contract and social contract. And so that's kind of how that started to develop. And now I've sort of lost my mind reading about contracts, gifts, promises, these things to think about Black freedom, quote unquote.
Yeah, I was going to, you know, maybe we can start off by having you give us a rundown of what the original masochist argument is, or how masochism is originally used in the realm of Black studies that you're encountering it in, and then kind of walking us through maybe how Deleuze, why does he emphasize the contract so much as opposed to the other thinkers who weren't when they were thinking about it? Like, why do they all overlook that in that theme? Yeah.
In Black studies, you know, there's a lot of sort of trying to stay away from masochism because it tends to imply some kind of complicity or some sort of desire for the violence, the punishment, the, you know, the oppression and so on. There's flirtations with it. The one thing I revisited recently was Amber Jamila Musser, her text Sensational Flesh, I think is the title, but I was reading.
I read that as well. Yeah.
And so there's discussion about it. I think the people who probably get the closest are those kind of in direct conversation with Farley, or who think of Farley as a fellow traveler, the Afro-pessimists. I think they probably get the closest to talking about something like masochism because it feels distasteful. And Farley's article, if you sort of follow the citations and go into reading like Gary in Your Pocket, which he really uses as the quintessential example of Black masochism, is this sort of desiring of punishment, eroticization of white violence and white sexuality. It's really hard to read. It's really like quite frightening. Like Gary Fisher's diaries are beautiful, but they're also this sort of testament to the frustration, the death. And he eventually does die of AIDS in the early 90s, that he was specifically isn't the right way to put it, but he was sort of okay with his own self-destruction. And this is, you know, in the era of Black Lives Matter, even as that's kind of drawn to an ebb, talking about Black people desiring our own destruction and our own suffering and punishment is it's hard to talk about. It's really difficult to talk about. And I'm not saying I think that we desire our own destruction, but there's certainly an element of that in there. And then, so with, could you just restate the second part of your question about Deleuze? Because I just want to make sure I actually answer things.
Right. And I'll maybe actually this might be flowing in a, I'll ask this first, is there's a black masochism, right, that is the focus here. Mm-hmm. And but what Deleuze is doing is a broader masochism. How do we, you know, and we understand maybe why the black study groups have been using masochism, but what is very particular about masochism in the context of black studies, I guess? Like, why is it so useful? And even if we're scared of using it, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, in a provocative kind of way, if you know, you accept the kind of Afro-pessimist tenet that the world is inherently anti-black and the black will always be in the position or non-position of slave with this world existing, right? The question is, why don't we enact why isn't there a slave revolt? Why aren't we burning it down, right? Why are we willing to accept our own suffering, our own punishment, the violence directed against us? And one of the answers to that question is going to eventually circle around the problem of masochism, around, again, perhaps not complicity, but some kind of wanting it, some kind of desire. And that's what's so, you know, that's part of where the animus against Afro-pessimism sort of derives from, is like you're calling black people masochists and that we want this. When, you know, look at all of our liberation movements, look at all of our NGOs, look at all of our, you know, our task forces, we don't want this. And, you know, that's kind of the hideous thing about it and why it proves to be such a thorn in the side. But masochism is a useful heuristic to think about why it is precisely we don't burn down the plantation if we're accepting that the world is a plantation.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not to jump the gun too much, but there's something about, you know, the contract becomes, I think, important because there's this option in all of Misak's stories that gets enacted at the end. They're just tearing up the contract. And I kind of, maybe as Sean has described at the end of our last episode, he kind of hinted at like what happens when it's really a ruse and there wasn't that option in the first place is, I think, kind of where it gets interesting and what makes the contract useful. And Deleuze said, so maybe now tell me what Deleuze is doing with the contract and like, why is he finding it so important?
Yeah. Okay, great. Yes. I remember that this was the initial second half of that question. So for Deleuze, like, you know, he's trying to pull out this definition of masochism that at the time of the writing of Coldness and Cruelty hadn't quite been worked out in the way that, you know, sadism and the had been, and there was considerably less attention to masoch versus, you know, sad, where there's been tons of attention because of course, why not? Why wouldn't there be? So he, you know, Deleuze sort of echoes the four sort of most important features of masochism from Reich, from Masochism in Modern Man, which are, let me make sure I can remember them off to the top of my head, are the, you know, the importance of the fantasy as being like the center of gravity for masochism. There's the provocative aspect, which is, you know, sort of eliciting the torture itself. The demonstrative aspect, which is not supposed to be confused with exhibitionism, but is more of a theatrics of the whole thing. You know, if you've ever found yourself for reasons that are your own in a BDSM scene, it is very much a scene. You know, it is the, you know, the moment of it all is built up. Oh my God. I mean, yeah. It's, you know, it's a whole production, right? And then the fourth one is, of course, the one I'm going to forget. Let me think. Persuasive. There's, right? Provocative. No. I forget the fourth one. Does anyone want to remind me? It's not like I just wrote a paper on this. Sorry?
Suspense.
That's the one. Suspense.
Delayed gratification.
Delayed gratification. You know, that's
I'm cheating. I've got your paper in front of me.
Thank you. Thank God, because my books are all out hidden upstairs in my little cubbyhole. So then, yeah, suspense, the waiting. This is where there's the play of anxiety and tension happening. So these are the four features of masochism that Reich has in the, what is it, the 1941 text, 1944, that Deleuze picks up and says, yes, these are all, I think we can accept all of these, but there's a fifth one, which is the contract. And Deleuze doesn't quite say this one is the definitive feature. I say this one is the definitive feature. Deleuze, it pays certain attention to it, absolutely. But I'm saying, well, you know what? I think this might even supersede fantasy, because especially if you're dealing with an actual sadist, the contract is a fantasy. The contract is this central feature of masochism, that we're going to have a duration of time where I can be punished, and then the punishment will stop. My desires will have been gratified. You, as my torturess, will have taken part, because in Masoch, the torturess is a woman, you know, and that will be the end. That's our period of performance. And this really caught my attention. It really caught my attention because one of the things I have noticed in the way that certain, let's say, political struggles have worked, especially Black political struggles, is there has been this attention to, like, look, this is the end point of slavery. This is where it is supposed to end. 1865, it's not supposed to be anymore. That's our signing. Our contract is, that part is concluded. We have our social contract now. This is, and we're supposed to be able to be full citizens. And there's all of this pointing to this contract on the one hand, there's no contract in slavery, but on the other hand, there is no social contract. And if there are black people who were freed at emancipation, we're not signatories to it. White abolitionists were signatories to it. Black people were objects of exchange in it. The social contract, if one were to exist, is not something that slaves signed in order to become citizens. It was, for lack of a better way to put it, a sort of impossible gift that, even if we go and try and find it, we're never going to find. It's not there. There is no social contract. So that's why I started paying such close attention to contract and Deleuze and being like, well, let's think about this. If we take it out of the bedroom, we take it out of, like, the moral masochism of Freud, and we take it into the, like, specifically Black political register, where we have this idea about contracts and this idea about the social contract particularly, and what do we do with this? Because this seems to illuminate the way towards something that we're not quite dealing with in Black studies.
You just said something that really sparked a connection for me, the idea that the contract supersedes all other aspects of the masochism. And when I think about, for example, our liberal education here in the United States, and that there has never been a contract that any former slave or any Black person has signed, nonetheless, we still have a social pedagogy of the contract in our education, in the sense that when we come to the point in history where we talk about the Civil War, we talk about the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Okay, now we take a test and we do a group project on it, and now we move on. Next, we're on to the Voting Rights Act, Martin Luther King Jr., and all of that. There's a test on that. There's a little paper and a presentation and speech. And in a sense, even though none of those things stack up to an actual signed contract, they are all speech acts that kind of agglomerate to form this kind of pseudo contract that's firmly embedded in the racial imaginary. And I just kind of want to run that idea by you, because I think when we look at, for example, the challenges with Black Lives Matter, not only as a broader movement, but as a specific organization and other largely liberal organizations that deal with racial struggles. I mean, you even mentioned in your paper how this particular masochistic logic is conterminous with, like, an NGO logic.
And I was hoping you could say more about that, because I thought that was really the most salient point that you made. That's where I think the rubber meets the road with all this stuff, is what kind of organization takes place? How do we pierce the veil on, for example, how certain organizations recuperate the notion of a contract in a way? And how does it cash out in terms of praxis?
So it's not funny. It's actually the opposite of funny. It's quite horrifying that very specific, you know, the Civil War happens. You don't really delve into the failed project of Reconstruction. You don't really. And I mean, I was educated in Canada, so my education slightly different. There was no slavery there. Don't know what you're talking about. We're the best. Don't look at the residential schools. That will bother you. Don't look at the slaves that were in Quebec or anything like that. Don't do that. That's just not worth your time. This is Canada, brand Canada. We did it. Peacekeepers. But, you know, you go from the failed project of Reconstruction that out to the Civil Rights Act, which is, you know, almost 100 years. And in all of that, there is a sort of constant racial terror going on, right? That is not really what you're going to learn about in your sort of K through 12 education. Sure, I agree. Yes, kindergartners should not be learning about lynching, but you know, there's a point in, I think probably in high school, where we could start talking about this, but you don't. But it appears like by removing that 100 years, what it makes it look like is, yeah, there's this pseudo contract, and look, you go from 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment to the Voting Rights Act, and look, you're getting all of this, and it works like a contract. Oh, you did it. And that missing 100 years, where, as Cydia Hartman does argue, particularly in the years just following slavery out into, you know, the 1920s, 1930s, just before like the Great Migration starts to really pick up steam, where a lot of Black people left the South and moved into the northern cities, you basically have a bunch of, like, a retrenchment of all of the mechanics of slavery, without the name, right? Where you have the sharecropping system, you have the, you know, the origins of what will be the prison system as it looks now, right? You have all of these things happening. Plus you have, you have total racial terror. You have, you know, people in the post-Confederate states writing to the, you know, the Bureau of the Bureau of Freedmen saying, we actually need help. Could you not shut this bureau down? Because the KKK are murdering us. They are just killing people. Like, you have people writing all of these letters into Congress, trying to make sure that the Freedmen's Bureau stays active, even though they're at best an NGO-ish kind of band-aid over the whole problem, right? By like taking out that 100 years, yeah, you get what looks like this pseudo contract, where it, you know, freedom is sort of legislated into practice and into life. And yet, even now, you know, 60 years post, you know, post civil rights, we still have an incredible amount of anti-Black violence, and we still have the mobilization of Blackness for anything but itself. This is sort of laying bare that there is no social contract for me. That doesn't look like a social contract to me. And, you know, I'll move into the NGO stuff in a second, but like, I'll be provocative because it's an election year. The Democratic Party is the worst offender here, where, you know, well, Black voters say this, therefore they are the plantation party. That's what they are. And they use Blackness in this, they deploy it in the same kind of way to do this work, and as a currency, as money, to make sure that they get the votes they think they deserve, because it's what's right. Like, that whole logic is submerged directly into the Democratic Party. That's what, you know, the South Carolina primary is all about, is getting those Black votes. See, look. And it's just another use of Blackness. And then from there, the contract itself, and I don't just mean the social contract, I mean contract as a form, is part of making of modern subjects. You know, it is the correct way in which one engages the state. It is the correct way in which one engages another person, especially if we're going to concede that we are all strangers meeting in a market. The only way to make sure that we don't complete, can I curse? Awesome. The best way to make sure we don't fuck each other over, especially if we're strangers and we have no obligations to each other, is to have a contract, a piece of paper that says, you do this, I do this. Perfect. Done. The bargain. This is the making of the modern subject. And the whole, you know, NGO industrial complex is founded upon this view of the individual as a contracting subject and the state as what we contract with, a counterparty to contracts, as well as, and this is the part that they tend to forget, the institution that makes contracts enforceable, that enforces contracts. So like the NGO, the movement that is saying like, you owe us, this is in the fine print. No, it fucking isn't. It never was. There's no contract. And so when this is how you mobilize is like, and this is what you think of as political action is saying, you owe us this because you said here, and that's the con, that's where you're making a mistake. There was no contract. There's no stipulations. You're talking to an institution, a sadistic institution, that part of its role is enforcing contracts. You're not contracting with it. You can't.
No, one of the things I enjoyed the most about your paper was specifically this idea of rereading everything financially in the lens of contract, that, you know, money is a credit contract, and this idea that, and we spoke about before the show, how you present the state as essentially gifting recognition or enforcement of various contracts. And so this, I wanted to actually go a bit further into what it means to say that the current set of institutions are sadistic. Because one of the things I really enjoyed reading was you talk about, you know, the old joke about sadists and masochists. The masochist says, hurt me. The sadist says, no. The masochist in the context of a political Blackness says, you need to hold to this contract. And then the sadistic institution says, no. So what does it mean to really talk about these institutions in terms of sadism? Is sadism kind of inherent to what it means to be an institution in that sense? Are there no masochistic institutions, only sadistic ones that produce masochism?
I think one of the few masochistic institutions you might find is the scene itself, right? The BDSM scene. And that's sort of by virtue of being what it is not an institution, right? But yes, I do increasingly think that institutionality is sadistic. It's not always for punishment, but it is, the network of institutions is meant in so many ways to be what we want to say is, you know, at least the hands and the feet and the mouth of the sovereign. Like it's that. And that's not a pleasant thing to think about, because that means it doesn't have to adhere to any law. It does not care. The contract is about law. The state doesn't. The institutions of the state do not care for laws, which is why I go on to say in the paper that like the state is and the institution is pure optionality. It can do whatever it wants, no matter what contract you think is there, including, you know, tearing it up and telling you to go fuck yourself. There's no contract. They don't, the institution itself doesn't believe in contracts. It is not a counterparty. If you make the mistake of thinking it's a counterparty to the contract, you are going to make massive political mistakes. It isn't. It is the pure option of always being willing to pay the price to breach a contract. You might use the state to enforce a contract, but it doesn't have to. it can tell you to go away and it can kill you. So, you know, that is sort of the joke, right? Is if you misapprehend what an institution is and you say, ah, this is my cold mother, the torturess, and I may not love her when she hurts me, but I love her. This is not her. You are not talking to her. You are talking to an institution, and that institution does not have to listen to you and does not have to think of itself as counterparty to your contract at all. It is always worth it for the institution to breach the contract. There's no price not worth paying. Yeah, there's just none. So yes, I do think institutions are sadistic. Even the university that pays my checks.
It does seem to have more, as you're saying, the Democratic Party earlier, it seems to make more of a sense to talk about liberal institutions than it does, even to some extent conservative or rightist ones, even to the extent that, I mean, in the UK, you know, it's easier to bribe a Tory MP than it is to bribe a Labour politician. They are so ruthlessly committed to the operations of the British state that they will say, well, we're nicer than the other guys, and then they'll hand the police as much money as they want, you know, or same with the Democrat. The contract with, you know, with Trump is, I'm going to make people you don't like really fucking mad, and I'm going to be cruel to them if you give me this. The Democratic Party is, we'll do what the fuck we want, but we're not even going to make you a contract. It's going to be, well, we're not the other guy. And that, because we're not the other guy, we're not going to make contracts. So the liberalism, in the extent, is kind of believes in itself so much because, of course, it is the representation of you, which is more real than you, of course, because the representation, you know, we were a representative democracy. Whoever owns representation owns democracy. And it kind of feels like this applies mostly to liberalism. Like, if you're talking plenty of conservatives, it's like there's something of an exchange there of like a currency of cruelty, whereas the cruelty is almost only going in one direction. We talk about liberal or social democratic kind of ways of viewing it. So I think it's hard not to get more, you know, it's election year in the UK as well, and the raw sadism of the Labour Party is never more present.
I last time I was in the UK, it was still the Corbyn years, and, you know, what was it, the movement was like out on the street, and it was really lovely to like meet some of the people who were, you know, canvassing and you know, getting people out to, you know, vote Labour. But you're right, you know, I am speaking about the liberal institution, but I also don't want to make the mistake of saying that, you know, conservatives are in some way not just liberals. They're just a different kind of liberal, right? They're not, you know, their differences are in style, not really in substance. They don't seem overly committed to, like, you know, taking apart parliament or something like that, even though, you know, that if nothing else could be fun to try, then watch them try, you know, it could be exciting or terrible or both. I mean, why not both? But yeah, it is definitely liberal institutions, because our institutions are liberal. In the worst sense of liberal. There was, you know, being Canadian, we had our very own couple of real freaks and perverts in the Conservative Party in charge of the government for a long time. And when I last lived there, it was Stephen Harper, this basically outline of a man who looked like his hair clipped on like a Lego guy. And I at the time I was in a relationship with someone whose parents were dyed in the wool liberals, like, you know, hated Stephen Harper, he's the worst, he's the worst, he's the worst, blah, 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 all of that. And trying to tell them that this is all liberal, that's all liberalism, guys. It was an impossible conversation. There was no conversation to be had. No one could hear it. You know, hearing that Trump is a liberal, or who's the freak in charge of the Conservative Party over in the UK these days? Is it Rishi Sunak?
Rishi Sunak, yeah.
Sunak, yeah. I mean, you know, liberal. He's liberal. He's just nastier. You know, he's not, you know, trying to put on this kind face and make the institution smile at you, which is really just it baring its teeth. yeah. So I'm just rambling now about conservatives and liberals, because I mean, you're all liberals as far as I'm concerned.
I have a brief follow-up, but no, if you want to go for it, go for it.
I mean, I'm just something that we also discussed in the members group, and I think as you've enunciated here, is like there's the foundational myth that there is a contract, right? The institution enforces contracts, yet is constituted itself by a contract, and that contract doesn't exist, and we kind of discover this. We discover the contract doesn't exist, and we're fucked. So, you know what? Because I think it was previously maybe described in the reading group we did that, like, you know, tearing up the contract is an act of liberation in the context of the black subject, but it that seems to be not necessarily what happens. Like that contract, what contract are you tearing up? So what does liberation look like then, or what's next? You know, it kind of gets murky now, I guess. And then the other thing, I don't know, just mulling over that. And the other thing I'm thinking about is, we don't want to be sadists. We don't want to be doing, you know, I don't know. There's a large amount of groups in popular scenes in New York, for instance, that love being self-proclaimed sadists and like doing politics around that and stuff, and like reactionary senses. Yeah, very strange. And
yikes.
So, yeah, one of my initial intervention or interests in this, and I guess as we discussed and with Tiger, is like supplementing Bataille with masochism. Like, when do we want to be a masochist, perhaps? And is like, do we all want to be masochists to each other? And like, is that just what you were talking about, the modern subject with contracts? Like, is that still a losing battle? Like, because we don't want to be the institution. And so maybe this begs the question that was also raised in the reading group, like, what's outside of masochism and sadism? But maybe what's next in your thought? Because this book, this chapter we've read was a chapter, right? What
are eventually, you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So like, where do you see this going with Deleuze? Because you also kind of point out that Deleuze, you know, doesn't go far enough, or maybe doesn't understand what the contract means in the context of slavery and kind of overlooks it. But yeah, what's next, perhaps?
What's next? I mean, that's probably the most nightmarish question you can ask somebody on the job market, is like, so where's your research going next? It's like, to hell. I don't know. I'm trying to get paid more, man. Well, that's not fair. But, well, yes, it is. But so I have to reveal something about myself here. We're going to get really personal, and I'm really sorry. Where it goes next is leotard. Because at the end of the day, am I a leotardian? That's aggressive. But there's something that Deleuze, and particularly the Deleuze of this era, you know, the sort of the era around 68, the anti-Oedipus, Thousand Plateaus kind of timing, doesn't and can't quite see in terms of, you know, the way that, you know, volatility and contingency and finance is going to kick off in 1973. And so he can't quite see it yet. And I'm not saying Lyotard can exactly see it, but he can see something there. And so this book will be sort of, it's sort of a prequel to what the next two projects really are. And the first one being like my big dissertation book on finance and blackness, very specifically, like in terms of collateral, assets, derivatives markets, options trading, and so on. And then there is another project that's sort of waiting in the wings about Lyotard, Fanon, and likely Derrida, about Algeria and the periodization of 1973. Because so many things happen in that year, including the advent of the Black-Scholes-Merton formula for options, for an option, or for options trading in a portfolio. This revolutionizes the way finance works, even as, you know, financial instruments have, you know, they're thousands of years old. This is a real moment where the fully hedged option sort of ascent, you know, that it can be created, that it can be that this in a portfolio, that this fully hedged option can exist, is if we follow what my mentor Bob Meister says. This is the creation of basically synthetic government bonds. They're riskless assets. And this seems important to me. And Lyotard, as he's talking about, especially in his evil book, you know, Libidinal Economy, which comes out in 74, right? He's talking about the movement of intensities, the, you know, the libidinal band as a Mobius strip that twists and turns into these volumes. This seems to catch on to something that Deleuze and Guattari, Deleuze himself, don't quite catch on to. They're still stuck in a sort of productivist, you know, machinic model that Lyotard isn't. So this first book that I'm working on right now, inshallah, I finish it, right, is really about the movement from Deleuze and Black Studies into Lyotard. That's really all I'll say about it in terms of that. But, you know, beyond simply the masochism, is there something outside sadism and masochism? I mean, I don't know, right? It seems like my instinctual answer is, if this is the political constellation that we're in, the answer is no, not right now. And that sort of demands the Afro-pessimist answer is, we got to move from horticulture to pyrotechnics or we are fucked. We have to get rid of this idea of the contract and the contracting subject as our sort of base political mode and burn that shit, get rid of it. So I don't know if it's the case that we all should want to be masochists. I don't know. I'm not saying no. I'm saying I don't know. But my suspicion is no. My suspicion is no. This contracting subject is part of the problem of masochism. And it's one I think we want to move away from if we want to be able to stop saying yes to all of this violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the relevant tale in Masoch's story, Venus and Furs, is that he trains his dominatrix to be the perfect, you know, dominatrix. And then she becomes too good at it. And then he loses control and he has the option to break it up, at least is kind of what's built in there. But we might not, the democracy that we fashion for ourselves, for instance, the liberal institutions that we fashion for ourselves, we might not have that ability to be like Masoch and tear it up. Right. So, yeah, it sounds like, you know, because it's either, you know, aligned with institutions or aligned with contracts and like a kinship role like that, or like what you're proposing sounds like, or suggesting the alternative might be is anarchy. Of a world where we don't have contracts, or a group that is not enforcing contracts. I don't know. So these are just things that I was thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. The contracting subject, the world of contracts is so ubiquitous and so powerful. Like, you know, like even just your friend isn't there when they say they're going to be there. And it's like, you said you were going to be there in this text. That is like, that is contractual thinking, right? Is you said you were going to be there. It's in writing. And it's like, it's really deeply embedded in the way we think of ourselves, right? Is the idea of the enforceable promise of, you know, we're promising subjects. That's a tough thing to break with and sort of keep the language and the world that we have, like our sense of the world, intact. And because that is our sense of the world, right? Is the bargain and the promise. And you said you were going to do this and I said I was going to do that. And then we have to do it. And, you know, I'm not saying break all your promises. Or don't make promises. No, no, no. But the thing to think about is, what do we do to sort of, if we can, breach the very specific contracts that we all sort of live our lives through. And I, you know, again, not between your friends and family, not even really with your sort of accepted adversaries. I'm not saying that, you know, don't break the rules of war necessarily. I'm not saying that. But in terms of like the big social contract, what does breaching it look like? And do you have to make yourself a monster to do it? That's really the question. And, you know, Fanon at the end of Wretched of the Earth is dealing with exactly this, right? Is the psychic outcomes of breaching the social contract. And it's a high price that people pay, and you don't come out of it on the, you don't come out the other side the same thing. You come out something different. And so there's a whole lot of divestment, like psychic, political and psychic divestment that would have to take place to get to breaching the contract. Because, you know, and this is, I think, potentially the great horror is that for Black studies, is that you enact this revolutionary violence, you enact the successful slave revolt. What are you on the other side? If we accept that freedom is yoked to slavery, that these things coexist, you're not going to be free. And there is even something to say, to suggest that you might not even be Black on the other side. And so if you are psychically and politically invested in this, and this might be the thing that has to go, this might be the thing that is sacrificed by breaching the social contract, truly, not just, you know, stealing cheese from Whole Foods. I mean, like really breaching the social contract, you know, creating the option for yourself. You might not be the same thing on the other side. And one of the originally this book was going to be just solely about George Jackson and Ivana Hoffmann, who was a Afro-German woman who went to fight in Syria with the YPG and was murdered, right? Originally, that was what this book was going to be about. And the both of them in there, she leaves behind a single letter, and, you know, Jackson has wrote two books, right? One of their preoccupations in both of these pieces of writing is not being the same on the other side. And that is the thing that makes masochists of us in a certain way. And that is what, while this book will sort of deal with that, that's sort of the horror at the center of it, is you might not be the same thing on the other side. And so I can't say what that will look like. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not Adrian Piper, you know, I haven't retired from my Blackness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, another convenient or coincidental part of the Venus and Fur story is Massac goes through a sadistic phase once he gets angry that it all falls apart, right? And he gets on the other side of it. Yeah. And I think, you know, the conversation of the promising subject just dovetail really nicely with what Sean is working on with us in Members, which is our ability, our free will that we're given, and the theological problems of that, and how we are held responsible for our actions. And that's a bit, when we've discussed that in the What is Blackness course, with suddenly, you know, the post-emancipation, they're now responsible for everything that's wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, welcome to freedom. You know, you got to pick up all these pieces. So,
welcome to freedom. It sucks here. You know, yeah. No, that's the free will issue is not my pet issue. Man, it sucks having to be responsible for things, and for things that you're not necessarily responsible for. You know, Black people in the United States were not responsible for the conditions in which they were released from slavery, quote unquote. We're not. But at the same time, that release is to follow Cydia Hartman, it is the creation of a subject that is meant to be responsible. And that is there's a real temporal boundedness in that subject, right? In that you really are, that all that past stuff, it's not important. We're meeting in the market right now. And the contract is about now.
Yeah.
Forget all that. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah. The other, again, why masochism is so alluring is the disavowal part of it. Like, you do, mommy take the wheel, right, is kind of what was happening. And so that's why it's alluring, perhaps, you know, in a political sense. And that's like, you know, we don't want to think about having to reconstitute the sovereign and our institutions all the time. So we just kind of, again, put it, it's done, we signed it, and now we can move on. I mean, and that's just it's also just so annoyingly relevant with like people like Elon Musk or online Twitter users that are like everyone that thinks white people are the worst ever, like the racist, but we dealt with slavery. It's all gone. Like, what are you talking about? There's no trauma. I'm just a white dude that's wanting to treat everyone equally. There's no color, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, Elon Musk is, if we must talk about the South African, if we must, you know, 1994 was only 30 years ago. You know, it's only 30 years ago. Good try, sir. But, you know, we've heard what the people who work in your factory call it. We know.
It kind of reminds me of the quote from Eric Williams about the English abolishing, creating institution of slavery solely for the pleasure of abolishing it. I mean, it sounds like this idea of the contract, the subject it presupposes, even not even the free will, but just the will. It's just so baked into the history of philosophy. And I think, particularly thinking about the activity of signing the contract, was itself a kind of exertion of the body, at least in how it's represented, a kind of labor enacted on something in order to somehow externalize one's will into an artifact. And I think what's so interesting, particularly thinking about slavery in this case, is that going back to, you know, the founding mythological philosopher of America, you know, John Locke, you know, his idea of ownership tends to come with the mixing of one's labor with things, but the labor that the slave mixes is not under their own will, it's under the command of another. So it's like, you know, we've mixed you, you know, we've paid for you, we've paid for your ticket, we've mixed your labor in with this, and therefore you're party to this contract, which doesn't even exist. And it's, I think, in terms of sort of breaking, I want to say breaking the spell, but something sort of like getting out of the libidinal investment here. There's something which is a distinction that you bring up, which I actually want to focus on just briefly, which is when you write that, to quote that, you know, the political sadist doesn't create his own political masochists. The political sadist creates victims that understand themselves as political masochists. And so there's that constitutive violence that constitutes the subject, you know, is the institution of the contract subject. And really, would you say that, so it's like part of way of getting out of this is to recognize that this is constitutively violent? This is, in a way, already social death.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is the big thing is so when I came to the Farley paper again, the word that kept coming up for me in classic and analytic fashion is misapprehension. Is like misapprehending what you're dealing with is to me so frightening. You know, it's why being sort of surrounded by white liberals is so scary, right? It's a get out. Let's get out. You know, you're like, oh, these people are fine. And it's like, no, no. Don't make a mistake here. But yeah, this is the big thing is that this is, we're talking about constitutive violence. We're talking about, and violence being constitutive of the making of the ground for the contracting subject, right? And the more it mystifies itself, the more powerful it gets. And, you know, it relates to what you were saying, Noah, about like, oh, you know, that's in the past. Don't worry about it. And it's like, no, this is what runs up and down. This is what like strides everything is this constitutive violence that is, I truly don't understand how people don't see it. I really don't. And it's, you know, it's like, it's always a shock when people are like, well, you know, it wasn't that bad. I'm like, no, it was that bad. And it's worse than you even can imagine, you know? And I should probably bring to my analyst that I laughed there. But regardless, the violence is constitutive in the way that the natal alienation, which is such an like the fundamental part of Patterson's, you know, social death, is constitutive. This makes you. It's the thing. And turning your attention away from that and thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm just, this will be over. The period of performance for this contract will come to an end. Or that was the period of performance. Now there's something new and you're not adhering to it. That the sadistic institution does not and cannot care. It does not love you. It will not love you. It is not mommy taking the wheel, nor is it Jesus. You know, it's something else, and it already has the wheel. And that's really what I mean about, you know, the sadist does not create a masochist, and they don't want each other at all. You know, it would be I feel as though it would be a true nightmare to walk into a scene and encounter a real sadist. That sounds awful. And to be mistaken about what you're encountering, that is becoming a victim, right? It really is. And the mystification that takes place in thinking that we're masochists, and therefore contract, look at it, read it, sign it. That doesn't stop the sadistic institution. It does not and cannot care. And so, yeah, that is part of that misapprehension is that no, you're a victim, babe. You know, it's that meme, you're a victim. And it's not just to, you know, sort of kowtow to victim mentality or anything like this. It's, but instead to really, really recognize that the violence is constitutive and it was against you. And that's what you actually have to deal with. And that's, you know, that's part of the psychopolitics of all of this is like, no, the violence is not, it's not just baked in. It is the thing. It's, you know, it's the flour, the sugar, the eggs, it's the pan, it's the oven, it's the whole deal. So we have to be able to look that in the face and stop understanding ourselves as part of this, as though we're signatories to a contract too. We're not. We're just not.
You took the words right out of my notes here, the word misapprehension. And I think it attends to this discussion of the details, you know, regarding Deleuze's theory of the divide or the incommensurability between sadism and masochism. And I was hoping that maybe you could extrapolate this analogy even further. I mean, that's kind of the game that we're in now. The one aspect of the misapprehension that I took note of was that it's, in the end, it's sadism all the way down. But the masochism appears, and then there's this kind of connection or the forging of a false oppositionalism between sadism and masochism. These categories are kind of reified in a way to make it seem as if they are opposed to one another. But when we get underneath it, part of breaking the spell, as it were, or getting out of the servitude mindset is seeing that the recuperation of the notion of a social contract or a pseudo contract comes from that continued buy-in to the imaginary of it. And once we do that, then we can see the real sadistic roots of it all. And one of the analogies that I see, or at least one of the connections to other places in Deleuze's work, is the idea of the, you know, active and reactive forces and ressentiment, because that's what the masochist does. They internalize that violence in such a way to make themselves a receptacle for it, but it can never truly connect to the bloodiest field of contestation, which is sadism against the world. And just kind of looping back to the whole discussion of liberalism, liberal ideology, liberal politics, it's all about reinforcing that misapprehension. And I was wondering if there was anywhere else to go with this analogy with all those terms on the table.
I'll try to answer this maybe through some of the habits and fixations of Black studies. When, you know, when the pandemic started, because you got to bring the pandemic in now, you can't avoid it. You know, there was an article published, I think, by Kianga Yamada Taylor there's this saying, and it is a saying that, you know, when America gets a cold, Black people get pneumonia, something like this. You know, there's this relation that happens where these things that are occurring in the Black community, sort of, and not just in the Black community, I should say, but they extrapolate outward in some way. And that's all fine and well, this idea, but this article came out sort of in response to those early days where it was like Black people were not dying of COVID or not getting COVID, and then were dying ferociously of COVID. And then the markets even reacted to, there was a huge surge in the stock markets when it was news that really only Black people were dying of COVID. Anyways, huge surge. This is what really set me off, made me completely insane initially. But the thing about, and it's not an analogy. It's not an analogy. The thing that I'm trying to get at, though, is that what can be done to Black people is so often the testing ground for what can happen to anyone else. It's not that everyone is always eligible for these things, be it slavery, be it dying from COVID. It's not that everyone's not like just completely ineligible or eligible, but Black people often we find are eligible first, and where sort of experimentation, research and development for how things will work play themselves out. Okay. So I think maybe, you know, like I say, not an analogy, but certainly a place where certain kinds of research and development do take place. And politically, we see this too, right? We see this with, you know, the Black Power movement becoming the Yellow Power movement, and then, you know, the American Indian movement. There were the Black Panthers, Yellow Panthers, the Young Lords that exploded out sort of based on this Black political experimentation with self-defense leagues, with armed resistance, with food programs and so on. And I say those all together because we should think of them all together. So it's not so much an analogy as much as it's, you know, politically, especially in the United States, what happens with Black people, what Black people do, often ends up being research and development for other things. The point, though, is to make it the case that that's not just what we're used for. Again, like the Democratic Party, this is where we learn, and therefore now we go and take it and make it our own thing. It's not about that, but instead that, you know, until Black people are free, none of y'all will be free. You just won't. And that's what I mean by, like, you know, research and development is that it's not that there's an analogy, but instead, if we can still be punished like this, the attention can be turned on others. And it often is. And so I'm not even saying, you know, Black people, we have to do it first. We have to do it this or anything like that. No, it's not about, you know, that kind of Black excellence, but instead it's like, until we're out of this problem, let's not say free. Our eligibility for this violence will always make other people's possible too. And it would behoove people to understand that, I think. That's what I think, you know, to quote another person from the member school, the visual technology of Blackness, of race, can mark one as automatically eligible, but anybody can be eligible. You know, white people were reduced to slavery. It's not the same thing as saying that one is structurally eligible to be a slave. That did happen. So I think there are real political lessons to be learned from this that are not just applicable to Black people. However, it is a thing that in terms of an interracial or intramural discussion need to take place among Black people, is that, you know, this masochistic fixation on getting the state, the institution to adhere to a contract that doesn't exist is going to get y'all killed, and it's going to get us killed. And so, yeah, not analogy so much, but it could ramify outward if it became the case that we were looking to for an end to the violence in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Teja, where can people find you? Where to find your work? I mean, what you got anything coming out soon people can read? I mean, we did actually read, just before this, we did actually read a couple of pieces you did on Deleuze and George Jackson. And yeah, they kind of inset. I mean, I got to admit, when I picked up the folks, if you've got a copy of Anti-Oedipus, go look for the footnote when they cite the line from George Jackson, running whilst looking for a weapon. One, it's not the correct translation, and I couldn't find it in any edition. And I got to admit, it did also short circuit me a little bit. But, you know, it's, where can you find your work? You know, if people want to catch up with what you're writing on, is there where people can go? Or is there anything you're currently doing with the Mimbrous School?
Yeah, no, so the, you know, the sadistic institution has made it the case that I'm not allowed to work at the member school and be paid for it right now because I'm on a visa. Bastards. Don't listen to that State Department. I love you. Don't you love me back? No. What am I working on? So I'm working on right now, it's all about this masochist option issue where I'll be dealing, yes, with contracts and Deleuze and options and Lyotard and blackness and the psychopolitics of blackness. So that's what I'm working on. That and if this podcast doesn't get me into huge amounts of trouble, which it might because of what I've just said about everyone being a slave, maybe the thing that will definitely get me into trouble is what I'm working on about Cydia Hartman and the revised edition of Scenes of Subjection, which it'll come out eventually. But I do have an article, a feature in Parapraxis coming out in the fall, I believe, fall, winter, somewhere in there. That is actually on Elon Musk, as it were, on the ketamine economy, ketamine as a drug, and leverage and over-leveraging and the white psyche. So that's what I'm writing about for them. So when that comes out, I guess you can read it. I don't know. Get mad at me. If you
we'll have you back on.
Okay. Yeah, sure. And if you want to find me, I'm being nuts on Twitter basically 24/7. So should I plug my Twitter? I don't know.
We'll throw it in the show notes.
We're all pretty nuts on Twitter. Throw whatever you want in the show notes. If there's anything legally worrying, don't worry. We can edit it out, or we can spit in the face and take the money. We can talk about ketamine accumulation and investment in the bladder of Elon Musk. Because that man is probably knives and crystals at this point.
It must be horrible. Like, he must be in pain. He looks like he's got K cramps at all times. Like,
I mean, I really hope so. I mean, same. Yeah, if anyone deserves it, you know. But on sadistic notes, thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's been amazing. Thank you so much.